Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Now, I'm really delighted to have such a fantastic speaker with us today. Julia Ebner is a research fellow at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue and a rising star in the field of terrorism research. She spent 2 years working for the world's first counter-extremism think tank, Quilliam, where she led research projects on terrorism prevention for the European Commission and the Kofi Annan Foundation, and also gave evidence to the Home Affairs Select Committee on far-right extremism. Julia's work focuses on the reciprocal radicalization that takes place between far-right and Islamic extremists and offers essential wisdom and practical suggestions on how to break this dangerous and complex cycle. There's no question to anyone that these are uncertain times. The war on terror has evolved from coordinated attacks by transnational terrorist organizations to nebulous agile groups sustained by a global recruitment pipeline, which inspires pop-up attacks all over the world. On the other side of this coin is the alarming resurgence of far-right movements in Europe, and the situation is no different on the other side of the Atlantic, where there's a new far-right wave in the US has alarmed officials in the FBI and in the Department of Homeland Security. In this instance, those groups who previously occupied the fringes are now center stage. How then can any society counteract this? Or have we all resigned to this crazy notion of this is the new normal? The Rage is a sobering read about the vicious cycle of Islamist and far-right extremism. It explores the drivers and conditions in which extremism thrives and therein reveals how we can address this global challenge. Please join me in welcoming Julia.
Thank you so much for having me. It is often those traits in ourselves that we despise the most that we subconsciously then project onto others. For example, I really hate it when people don't finish their sentences, and that's because I have a bad habit of doing that myself. I'm trying my best today to not do that. This is what, in Jungian psychology, it's called the shadow. It's this effect that led me to start the research because I started seeing that actually far-right and Islamist extremists had more in common than they would like to admit. And that this led to a very paradoxic relationship between the two forms of extremism, because they had so many traits in common and so many of the narratives and worldviews they shared that they even complemented each other and that they mutually reinforced each other, that I really became interested in this subject and I wanted to look deeper into this effect. So I wanted to take a very human approach to it because I felt that extremism and radicalization is such a human process that the best you can do to understand it is to really speak directly to the people involved in it. And so I started by going undercover to two events organized by two diametrically opposed extremist organizations. That was precisely a year ago. On the 5th of November, there was coincidentally there were two events on the same day, so I started my day by having cider with some people from the English Defence League in the English town of Telford, where they organized a rally against what they call Muslim grooming gangs. And then in the evening of that day, I went to a conference organized by the international Islamist extremist organization Hizb ut-Tahrir. Of course, I was the only non-Muslim there, but they were all very welcoming, and I appreciated that they shared their stories with me. What I found after this day, and when I reflected on the next morning, was that so many of the narratives that they shared with me were quite similar, and that whichever event they spoke about, they always related it back to this big master narrative of there is an inevitable war between the two monolithic blocks of Islam and the West, and that there is this inevitable conflict, either ongoing or imminent conflict, of races or cultures. And that is something where I felt that there might be an interaction between these narratives, because obviously they are mutually beneficial to both sides. This was not the only parallel I found, and it's unsurprising to find these narrative parallels when looking at how many of the intellectual elements they also have in common, and that they draw sometimes on even the same ideological sources. For example, in 1935, Alexis Carrel published his book, L'Homme, cet inconnu. And this book, what most people know is that it served as an inspiration for the pro-fascist Vichy regime in France. But what not so many people know is that it also inspired Al-Qaeda's favorite ideologue, Saeed Qutb, who cited this work almost more than any other. This also means that because they're so close to each other, they sometimes even adopt each other's recruiting strategies and each other's propaganda. So for example, the first far-right group to be banned in the UK, National Action, which was banned last December, it modeled its propaganda very much after the propaganda that ISIS produces. You have the same glossy propaganda materials. And in the same way, they even showed jihadist videos for their training camps, which again imitated the training camp styles of ISIS training camps. On a tactical level, I think the week that saw the Charlottesville attack, and a few days later we had the attack, the vehicle attack in Barcelona, that really illustrated some of the tactics that they also have in common. And when I looked at the encrypted messaging apps used by both Islamist extremists and by far-right extremists, here you can see pictures of those, they both said, oh, we should use more of these improvised vehicle attacks because that should be the preferred, that should be our preferred weapon choice because it's so easy. And it seemed like they almost inspired one another. So in many ways, they're two sides of the same coin, which means that sometimes they're so close to each other that we even see some very strange conversions. There were multiple cases of neo-Nazis all of a sudden becoming jihadists. That shows really how closely related their worldviews are. There were examples from Germany, from the US, from countries really all across Europe as well with these cases. On the other side, we also have very strange connections and relationships. Sometimes they agree on elements, such as anti-Semitic elements, are present in both on both far-right and Islamist extremists' sides. And this was illustrated very well in the attack against the kosher supermarket, the Hyper Kasher, in Paris, in the outskirts of Paris in 2015. You probably remember that happened a few days after the Charlie Hebdo attack. And the perpetrator, which was the ISIS-inspired jihadist Amedi Coulibaly, actually had links, as the police later found, to a person that was very that was associated, was a member of an extreme right group in France, and that was Claude Armand, who provided him with the weapons, who was the weapons smuggler for the Kalashnikovs that were used in that attack. It is not just these parallels that are interesting about this, this paradoxic relationship between the two sides of the extremes, or between probably all forms of extremism. It's also this mutual reinforcement or amplification of each other's narratives. They can use the other side to make a point about how actually all Muslims are terrorists, or how the entire West is evil, to make a point about how these monolithic blocks, or as they perceive the world, would lead to this inevitable war of races or of cultures. And unfortunately, this is also sometimes reinforced by far-right politicians, by populist politicians, who would also break down the worldviews to this very simplistic view. And we can see that for example, Marine Le Pen was probed by the police for sharing ISIS propaganda materials, of course, to make a point about Islam being evil. But then also to the same extent, we have cross-references from ISIS side to Trump or to other far-right politicians. They often show them in their propaganda videos also to make a point about how and the entire West is racist or is Islamophobic. They're very mutually useful, their narratives. And of course, within the last few years, we had really a drastic rise in both Islamist terrorist attacks, jihadist violence, but also in far-right attacks. And that is often something that is not reported to the same extent. There is a bit of an inconsistency in the approach that governments and the media have taken in labeling far-right violence as terrorism, if ideologically inspired. When I looked at the data a bit, I saw that actually these forms of violence show some form of correlation, or at least they seem to spike at roughly the same time. So we have a higher frequency of far-right extremist attacks around the same time as we have jihadist violence, which again shows this tit-for-tat violence effect, this mutual provocation into more extreme action that is, again, beneficial to both sides. This doesn't really say anything about causality, but that's why I looked deeper into some of the case studies and really went into the field research. And what I found there was that in some of the geographic areas where there is a high concentration of far-right extremism, of far-right extremist activities and groups, there's also a higher concentration of Islamist extremist groups and Islamist extremist activities. And one of the best examples for this in the UK is probably Luton, which most of you will know has seen these confrontations between the English Defence League on the one hand and Al-Muhajirun on the other hand. That's just one example. We have these examples in Germany and in France and also in some of the cases in the US that I looked at as well. And it's one of the most recent examples of this mutually tit-for-tat violence or of these interactions between far-right and Islamist extremists are the town where the perpetrators of the London Bridge attack are from. Which they're from. They're all from Barking. This is Barking in June 2010, where there was a homecoming parade for soldiers, for British soldiers, and from Afghanistan, and that saw a confrontation between far-right extremists who would be there to demonstrate against Islam, which they perceived as evil, and there were Islamist extremists who would then escalate the tensions also with the far-right extremists. When looking at some of what I found online, it's interesting how they often relate violence committed by either side to, again, this generalization about the entire other identity group. So, for example, when Charlottesville happened, this is an ISIS-affiliated Telegram channel in the encrypted messaging app Telegram, where they shared a picture of Charlottesville saying, oh, well, this is actually the true face of America. It's racist, to make a point about the entire West. Sometimes they also do this with elections. For example, after both the German election and after the US election last year, they shared a lot of comments, sometimes even celebrated the election of far-right, or that far-right political parties and candidates are gaining ground because it would help them to show that the entirety of America is actually racist or Islamophobic. So, for example, one of them, this was a Twitter account that had a very good cover. They used a coffee kind of background to not be flagged to the security services. They managed to exist since 2012. I then, of course, flagged it, but so it was taken down. But both on Twitter and on Telegram, I saw a lot of these examples of them relating Trump to this racist face of the West, this global oppression of Muslims by the West. And one of them even said that, I prefer a straightforward Donald Trump telling Muslims what half of America thinks of them than a wicked hypocrite Clinton snake. I wish the British were as vocal in their hatred for Muslims as the Americans are. Maybe then the Muslims here would unite against falsehood. So these examples really showcase how they use each other's narratives. So the question is, of course, in a way, maybe Trump and maybe far-right politicians feed into this or are even a gift to ISIS, as many security experts have claimed. The The question is, of course, what can we do about it? And I know this is giving a very pessimistic outlook, so I want to end maybe on a positive note. And I think that although I've been studying the evil sides in people pretty much every day, I still believe in the positive sides within every single individual. And I think that that's also something that, when returning to that shadow concept of Freud, of Jung, inspired by Freud, is that he saw that even this shadow was a potential or the seed of creativity, and that if we become aware of it, and if we maybe also rehumanize the debate, that's now my own interpretation of it, but if we rehumanize the debate around extremism, and probably also stop talking about us and them when talking about extremists and the middle ground, and also re-rationalize the debate, then maybe there is a potential to reverse some of the effects that this has had and how it has ripped apart our societies. And I hope that that's also something, or I think that that is something that where the arts can also play a role in rebuilding the bridges that have been destroyed by these terrorist attacks. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Julia, for a very sobering and revealing scoping of the problem and the challenge facing us today. I thought I would touch on three different things which came up a lot in the book and in your presentation. First off, there's very much a us versus them, us versus the West, that very, very strange narrative, which plays, I think, into what we have been fed since we were children, this Hollywood narrative of good versus bad, evil, those people over there. And it puts us in these binary positions. And, you know, we see it decaying our politics now in most mature democracies. Where do we find the middle? How can the middle find its own narrative? And how can it be powerful enough to penetrate the very intoxicating narrative of the radicalization of that the extremists use?
I think, that is the most difficult question. But I think that probably now in the last few years, the extremists have been very strong at creating this counterculture against the establishment. And that has been very appealing, especially to younger generations who were upset with the status quo. And I think it's necessary to probably also maybe create a counterculture to this counterculture. But of course, it's always more appealing to have these simplistic solutions to a very complex world. But I think it might be possible to have a more appealing counterculture, but also giving voices to the middle grounds, which are often not really heard because sometimes the media also gives more attention to the extremist sides, to the fringes, because it's more interesting in a way.
More sensational.
More sensationalist, yeah.
In the presentation, you brought up the use of encrypted messages, and I have to say, I'm still in the Skype world, MSNBC, MS Messenger world. I'm not into Telegram and WhatsApp, I just started using. But anyway, the terrorist organizations have really exploited social media. And, you know, we have seen, you know, Facebook claims it's not a media organization. It is. We've seen what fake news have done. And I won't get into that right now. But, yeah, we've seen the explosion of fake news on social media and what that has caused. What do you think these platforms should do? Have they done enough? I am curious to find out what your take is on it. Because I don't know. Is the genie out of the bottle? Have we gone over the cliff that it can't be pulled back? Do we need more regulation? Do the governments need to do more? What can be done?
There's a bit of a there's a problematic relationship between the takedown of contents, which is of course important for companies like Facebook and Twitter to do, and they have really stepped up their efforts to do that for both Islamist and far right extremism, and also other forms of extremism, anti-LGBT, far left extremism. But I think that's not enough because it always has to be complemented with some form of empowerment of the positive voices and of the alternative narratives. Because purely focusing on negative measures often actually can be counterproductive because it pushes the extremes to alternative platforms. And that's something we've had in my work at ISD where we follow the trends on social media and this massive platform migration that is right now happening to encrypted messaging apps, but also to they are creating their own news networks, they're creating their own even fund crowdfunding networks and financial structures online, and their own chat forums and political discussion forums. So I think there is a need to also find a solution, a long-term solution to that, that is not simply reshifting their, basically creating parallel societies online in a way.
Do you think it's important that because we talk about, I often hear that they talk about the war, well, we used to use the phrase the war on terror in military terms. You know, we will attack the enemy where they live. But they, you know, you, in the book you mentioned these virtual places where they live, the virtual places where they inhabit and propagate this radicalization. Do you think that the government should actually penetrate those virtual areas in a military sense, almost weaponizing these platforms?
I think there's probably, there's sometimes the need for it when it's actively really calling for violence or when there are violent contents that can be of an imminent security threat.
Yeah.
But I think in the long term, it's worth thinking about different approaches as well. And especially what we also do at ISD in our project work is to, for example, provide digital literacy training, both for young people, but also for teachers that can then pass it on to their students. Because I think it's really necessary also, for example, in regards to fake news and conspiracy theories, which play a huge role in the radicalization process, for young people to be aware and to be able to really tell apart from what's true and what's fake and to question everything that they're being fed online.
Yeah, because critical thinking is quite important to teach at a young age. You brought it up mildly in the presentation, this issue of foreign fighters. Recently, there was a report came out this week about the number of foreign fighters returning home, about more than 5,000 of which. You know, and it's particularly concentrated in Europe. The UK has about 700, Germany, France, 300, 400, roughly. What can be done to, I guess, prevent the continued radicalization of foreign fighters? Are they part of the radicalization process? Can they be de-radicalized? I know there's there's a debate out there. You know, once they've gone beyond a certain point, they can't come back. What is your take on that?
Having spoken to so many former extremists, both on the jihadist side, but also or on the Islamist extremist side and on the far-right extremist side, I would really advocate for a very human approach again to this, because I think that it is reversible and that de-radicalization can work if done properly. And I think that really starts by looking at some of the positive cases and also using former extremists to help with those processes of de-radicalizing people who are returning, who might be very traumatized. I think these traumas that they have gone through are also something that they might pass on to the next generations, and that is something we will have to be careful that.
What we see in the press is fear around returning foreign fighters. I'm not aware of what the UK government is doing in respect to continuing this de-radicalization. Are there any programs in place? Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so I think in general, the PREVENT program and the anti-counter extremism strategy of the government is, of course, a very controversial topic in counter-extremism circles. But I think there are some elements that have worked really well, and especially some of the mentoring one-to-one programs, some of the efforts to engage directly with people who are either at risk or who have been in the process of radicalization, is something that has worked well in many cases. And I think there's probably more potential to work closer with different partners, both from to really kind of fill the gaps between civil society actors, who might also families can play a very big role in de-radicalization, because often parents are the closest. Sometimes extremist organizations become almost a replacement for families. Mm-hmm. And when they lose this social network around them and they have to somehow make a return back into normal society, it can be really helpful for them to feel that they can be part again of something.
I think it's time we turn over to the audience. I don't want to monopolize the conversation. We will take a round of questions from the audience. I'll go three at a time. Gentlemen here, we waited the mics get to you.
We take three at a time.
Thank you for a very interesting talk. I haven't had time to read your book, but my question is about the language that is used, because I perceive extremism as not a flat, linear shape. It's almost circular, with people at different extremes with different justificatory narratives coming from all directions. And I wonder what part language plays in this. So, for example, you talk about radicalization. Could you talk about criminalization? And you talk about the religious justification. Could you talk about the anti-religious justification? And rather than talk about ISIS, talk about Daesh or whatever other word is a better description of what they're about. So is the language something that we could change to frame this debate in a more intelligent way?
Okay, thank you for that. I'll take that one at the back.
Is it first necessary to define what we mean or what we're concerned about in terms of extremism? I have extreme views on rural broadband. I think it's a waste of public money to invest in the last 0.5% of the population to get them really good broadband speeds. It's better to improve the general quality for everybody else. That is enough to get me pelted with eggs in certain communities. But is that the sort of extremism? I mean, I don't particularly want to be the target of government policy on counter-extremism. But I mean, what is the nature of the extremism we're concerned about? Is it simply about promoting violence, or is it simply about creating a climate in which some people see violence is acceptable? And if that is the case, have we got an issue with the polarization of our politics? This country, Brexit, anti-Brexit, US, Trump, immigration in many parts of the world. How do we bring political dialogue back more towards the center? Because when the dialogue is between two groups that do not coincide, they legitimize those who are perhaps crossing over the line in other ways.
Thank you for that. One more.
Yeah, hi. I also enjoyed it very much, if enjoyment is the word for it. But two things I think are incredibly important. One is certainly a driver is poverty, and the other is certainly intervention by the West. I mean, the vast rise in jihadism, et cetera, is only after we've intervened in certain countries in the Middle East. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about that. It'd be great.
Good. Thank you. Well, I hope I remember all of them.
Yes.
So I think the question about language is a very intelligent one. I think we should probably have more of a focus on that, and it's not being addressed enough, also especially how the media and how politicians talk about it as well. And I think often what we suggest already in the language, also in terms of the inconsistency that I talked about in the language that is being used to the different forms of extremism, that causes that again inspires the different narratives, or that shapes the narrative very much, especially in the aftermath of terrorist attacks. It's a lot about language that is being used by the media that really then decides on what is done. And I think it's worth also deciding, relating to your point about what is extremism. I think that the government definition of extremism as a fundamental opposition to, they would say, British values, I would rather say human rights, or universal human rights, is an important one. And I think that is also why it really applies to all forms of extremism. On the point regarding identity politics or the polarization, I think that is something that feeds into the whole dynamic, because it reinforces the narratives on both sides. I think I wouldn't call Trump an extremist, but I would say that he's fueling that climate of polarization. And extremists on both sides of the violent extremist spectrum would try to use polarization, would use strategic polarization to drive these rifts within our societies, and to make this war that they wish for between Muslims and non-Muslims more likely. And in terms of the underlying grievances that drive people into extremist networks, I totally agree with your point about foreign policy and poverty. I think that is one of the main drivers, and also what I want to emphasize here is that this book doesn't, this reciprocal radicalization effect is, I think, something that accelerates a dynamic. This is not the only driver, if even a driver. It's definitely an amplification effect, but I think that the drivers are much more multifaceted, and that often identity crises feed into that, but definitely also grievances about socioeconomic grievances, but also foreign policy grievances. And that's something when monitoring the ISIS channels, the Telegram channels, is also something that reoccurs again and again. They use examples both of violence that is being perpetrated by the West in their against their countries, against Muslims, as they would see it in the war in Syria. They would share pictures of dying civilians, and discrimination at home. That those are the two examples that they would then often use to recruit people and to feed into their narratives. Yeah.
Let's take another round. We have time for another round of questions. Young lady at the back. Go three.
Hi, thank you for your talk. I'm interested in this from a behavioural science perspective, and I was very interested to hear that you said that ex-radicals are helping other people to avoid radicalisation, because that would be what the evidence suggests would work very well. But the other thing I'm interested in is that I was reading that when you have these very simple narratives, just getting someone to accept that things could be a little bit more complex, that could be quite effective. In your experience, does that happen?
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed that talk. Thank you. And I think your basic thesis about the complementarity of the two narratives is absolutely unassailable. I mean, it really obviously it makes sense. I'm not so sure it's a paradox. But given that it makes so much sense, what would some of the obstacles be in your mind to a broader, a greater understanding of that complementarity, or maybe to put it another way, in whose interests might it be that it's not more widely understood?
I'm wondering, from an empirical point of view and on the basis of the people to whom you have spoken, the extent to which we should be frightened of those people who are returning from the Far East. My impression is, and it's only an impression because I don't know any more than what I've read, is that those people who've perpetrated these crimes are people who have been homegrown, people who have problems of various sorts. I'm not aware of any of these events which have involved people who have actually returned from Syria or Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever, that they've been the ones who've perpetrated these events. So I'm questioned from an empirical point of view on the basis of the people to whom you've spoken, how frightened should we be of these people who are returning?
I think I will start with the last question, go back to the first question. So I spoke mostly to people here in the UK and in France and Germany, and it's true that most of the terrorist attacks have been carried out by homegrown terrorists. And I think that exactly that also shows that, in a way, it's also this local, this discrimination that they, or this perceived discrimination that they experience in their home countries, that is something that drives them towards extremism. There have, of course, been cases of radicalized individuals who were, or returning individuals that are still holding radical views, which many of the politicians are more concerned about than about the homegrown terrorist aspect. Or it's also been exploited by some of the far-right populist parties, who would say it's all migrants actually that bring these problems to us, because it's harder to accept that it's actually something that might come from within our own societies. Which the second question, I think, was about
obstacles to understanding what seems to be a very sensible basic thesis.
And I think that is precisely one of the things that what I just said about, it's actually something that might sometimes grow out from our own culture. Terrorism is, extremism is. I think that is something that makes it really hard for us to tackle it, because it also means that we'd probably have to admit to our own mistakes, the mistakes of the political failures and the political establishment, but all failures of feeding into these problems. And especially when talking about far-right extremism, that is something I sensed as well, that there's many people are uncomfortable talking about far-right extremism because it's something that really comes from our own culture in a way that is supposed to protect our own race or culture. So it seems that it's more difficult to accept that and as a form of extremism than it is to accept the extremism coming from a very unfamiliar alien side from jihadist violence. The failure to, the reluctance to kind of see them, the two of them as both being detrimental to our democratic systems, I think is also preventing us from dealing with the symbiotic relationship. About the behavioral side of talking to former extremists or using them for the de-radicalization processes, I think often for example, the intervention providers that I spoke to, also some of my former colleagues who were ex-Islamist extremists, they were really good at relating to some of the challenges that extremists are faced with. Ivan Humble is also a good example. He was a local EDL coordinator who is now leading campaigns to help people he was previously in touch with from EDL circles, from far-right circles, to help them exit these networks by showing them that actually there is a way, that there is a life after hatred, which is also what one of the campaigns is called. But it's possible to still, even if they have to give up their entire social network, which can take a lot of courage, it's good to have a positive role model. And it also makes them trust these people more because they feel more represented or more can identify with these problems. And I think there was a second sub-question.
It was, does it work introducing, you have a very simple narrative. If you introduce the idea of complexity, say things don't always, doesn't explain everything, and then does that then help to bring people back?
Oh, yes. So I think breaking apart these black and white narratives is something that probably should also be done a lot more, both within educational systems in schools, but also that families could use in the education. This is also why we had a lot of family civil society-led campaigns where we tried to empower families to really teach their children critical thinking skills. We did a lot of these projects in North Africa and the Middle East, but I think the British government has also now introduced some of these critical thinking skills in the school curricula. So hopefully that will have an impact. I think there is always a risk of, if it's not done properly, if on paper the strategy is perfect, if it's not implemented in a positive way, then that might be counterproductive. But
Julia, I'm interested in what you just mentioned, and I think someone brought it up, a member of the audience brought it up before, in terms of even if you break out, an individual breaks out of their social network that would push them, whether it's to Islamist extremism or far-right extremism, you know, how can we address the identity politics question? Because I think that is the thing that, to me, I mean, I'm not an expert, but to me that's the thing that pushes people over the edge, the disaffection. I was very, heartened to see in the book about this place. We talk about place-based policy here at the RSA, but very much a place-based concentration of, you know, this radicalization. You talked about it in the presentation. There's this odd symbiotic relationship, which is very dangerous, that one informs the other. But it's very much place-based. It's very much situated in these communities that have been, I don't want to use the term, but left behind or have been removed from economic activity. How can local councils, how can civil society, how can governments address that? Because to me, that's the linchpin.
Yeah, I agree. I think we see it both on a local level, but of course also on a broader level. But then in these areas, there was the effects were even stronger, and these, especially these tit for tat effects, were a lot stronger there. I think increasing societal resilience to, for example, terrorist attacks. Of course, these are made and staged by terrorists to instill fear and to provoke the public into this us versus them thinking, into increasing these polarization effects that would then help populist politicians into power and would then again feed back into creating a backlash against from Muslims who will then feel alienated and rather again more likely to join Islamist extremist networks again. So it's this whole strategy in a way, it's also what Al-Qaeda used in their management of savagery strategy, because all they wanted to produce with terrorist attacks is to escalate the tensions to then to alienate the two, because this is the strategic polarization that I meant, because it means that people have to take one side or the other. And I think it's worth increasing societal resilience so that everyone feels that actually we don't have to take one side or the other. There is also a middle way.
Mm. Yeah. I think we have time for another round of questions. Mike, just wait on the mic. Wait on the mic. Right here.
Yeah, I was... thank you, first of all, for the presentation. I was very interested in your story about the rehabilitation. And as I was reflecting about my own knowledge of the matter, which is strictly through a mainstream media, I just wondered what's the role of the mainstream media? Because if you read it, it's mostly about fear. It's mostly about bad things or negative things. So I was wondering if you had researched this aspect, the role that the mainstream media could play maybe to positivize the situation.
Any other questions? The back, straight at the back.
Thank you. Come here so I can actually see you. That was really interesting. I was wondering whether you have done any research looking into if there are parallels also with the far left, because I know that there are a lot of, you know, similar tactics used and, you know, common enemies of the far right and far left, but I wonder whether it relates to your research as well.
Another question in the corner.
Hi. I'm with an organisation called London Youth, and we work with young people across the city, including Barking, and we have a Tackling Youth Violence Network. And the piece I've been to sort of talks at the Ministry of Justice and various other bodies, the piece that always seems to be missing is if you're going to reach people, you have to look at organisations outside of school and outside of the family, because often the young people that get involved in gangs and then can sometimes get radicalised are not in education, or they're not in a home with a trusted adult. So I don't know if in your book if you mentioned anything about the role that youth workers, youth organisations, really grassroots community organisations can play in disrupting this narrative for young people, and particularly peer-to-peer education.
Yeah, absolutely. I will again start with the last question and go back to the first question. It's somehow easier. I agree. I think the role, especially of peers, is something we also found in some of the studies we did at Quilliam, but also at ISD with our youth labs projects and our youth focus projects, that especially peers can play a huge role in counter speech, providing credible, because there are such credible messengers that young people would more likely to listen to their peers than to their parents or any kind of authority. And it has worked really well in some of the campaigns that we did, but also I speak about it a bit in the book, but that is something we mostly do in hands-on projects by working with youth organizations and with young people who would also be more tech-savvy and would therefore be more likely to interrupt some of the online extremist efforts to spread propaganda, or could, especially older siblings, we found in one of the surveys that we did within families, older siblings were found to be the best messengers and the best people to really do these counter-speech efforts. The question about the far left, what was it again?
Similar,
yes,
tactics.
Exactly. I absolutely agree, and I think that is something that is, to be very honest, that is one of the shortcomings of my book. I couldn't look at everything. It was already a lot of work to kind of look into everything on the far right, all the ideologies and everything on the jihadist side. But that is definitely something that is also becoming more important now that we see a rise in far right extremism. There might also be, again, this reciprocal radicalization effect that also applies to the relationship between the far right and the far left, which we also see in the US now. Between the anti-fascist movements and the Antifa and the far right. And I think that is something that probably there will be more potential for future research and for future books. But at the moment, I do see that, I think, although the strategies and the tactics, there are definitely also parallels here, but I think that the most dominant and most dangerous forms of extremism right now, because simply in terms of attacks and in terms of how frequent they happen, what dominance or what power they have over society, I think it's really jihadist and far-right violence where we saw so many of the attacks in recent years. And that's also why I focused on these two. But the same can be applied to any form of reciprocating violence. I think the case of Northern Ireland is also an example that many academics have looked into to examine this effect of cumulative extremism, of reciprocal radicalization. And probably it's also worth learning from history when dealing with these matters and not reinventing the wheel, when in fact these forms of these dynamics, we've seen them before, also in the 1920s in fascist Italy, for example.
Rehabilitation, yes, and the role of the media.
Oh, right, exactly, yes. The role of the media, of mainstream media. I don't like the term mainstream media, but that's exactly what everyone now seems to call it. But I totally agree with you that they play a huge role in because of the sensationalist reporting that they are sometimes forced into now because of the 24 hours news circles, because they face so much competition from the alternative platforms, that I think often they spread exactly the same binary worldviews, and the language that they use is also really sometimes so sensationalist that extremists don't even have to share articles, fake news articles. They also often share the articles from mainstream media. And I think when they talk about rehabilitation, it's sometimes a very, they're especially some of the media outlets that have more emphasized the dangerous sides of returnees and of former extremists, that is something that might be beneficial to them in the short term because of the clicks and baits that they're competing for. Mm-hmm. But I think I agree that it is not a good strategy for the long term. And I have a chapter about the media, where mainstream media is one of the topics that I speak about. But of course, that we haven't even started speaking about all the fake news and the conspiracy theories and the alternative media platforms. But yeah.
I think I'll close with the last question. Mm-hmm. So what can be done? I mean, you did a really good diagnosis of the problem. But what can be done by the intelligence community, people in your line of work, counter-terrorism, counter-extremist experts always talk about there's a near war, there's the immediate threat, and there's the far war, what's coming around the corner. We have seen just in London, you know, after certain attacks, you know, the authorities make different changes and we observe certain things. But what is coming around the corner? How can we deal with this reciprocal radicalization, and what is the next wave, if you will?
The problem is that it has created almost a chain reaction of the public is putting increasingly pressure on politicians to take very disproportionate action in response to these terrorist attacks and to kind of clamp down on the sometimes freedom of speech, sometimes some of the civil rights that form the foundation of our democratic systems. And I think that's also one of the things we really want to maintain in the face of terrorism, because that's exactly what extremism is trying us to do. So I think the government would need to complement an approach that, of course, the security services have to do their best to prevent attacks from happening, and that might include some of the more draconian measures. But I think it's important to really focus more on the civil society-led measures. And governments can work closely with civil society and empower them to really play a bigger role in this. Because in a way, it's like challenging taboos that we've challenged before with homophobia or with other things that were the spread of ideas that have just become unacceptable in societal terms. That is something I think civil intolerance civil intolerance, but legal tolerance is probably the approach that would work best in most of the cases.
I think what would be your view in terms of, I mean, there's individual governments, but what's your view about, you know, cooperative intelligence sharing, perhaps, or even having some sort of, I mean, the architecture for counter-extremism is a bit wonky, to say the least. What advice would you give to the government on that?
There are really three dimensions where, and that is not to sound pessimistic, but where extremists on all sides are far ahead of the curve and far ahead of the government's responses. And I think that is the technological side, how they are always early adopters of technologies. They create their own bot networks, and also ISIS speaks a lot about using technology now to spread, to go into the mainstream, to coordinate in encrypted channels, but to move into the mainstream. The second level is international cooperation, where I think both extreme right-wing organizations are becoming better and better at coordinating across borders, and Islamist extremists are also building transnational networks. So I think international collaboration is really deeply needed. Mm-hmm. And the third dimension is one of the things that I addressed earlier, this counterculture, where they weaponize youth culture to bring in more, persuade more young people to embrace their ideologies. I think that is something, those are the three levels where really extremists have been, unfortunately, a bit ahead of the counter-responses. So I think the governments would have to focus on all of these levels, and that's also what I mean by complementing purely security-led, law-heavy measures and more the sharp-end measures, complementing those with the soft-end civil society-led measures, focusing on technology, culture, and transnational coordination.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Julia. Sadly, this is all we have time for today. Julia's new book, The Rage, is on sale outside in the foyer. I'm sure she'll be happy to sign a copy for you when you leave. But before we go, please allow me to compliment Julia on handling such a very highly complex topic and diagnosing the problem and the challenge facing us and giving us a glimmer of hope of what we can possibly do to address it. So thank you very much, Julia.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.